Real quick, before we get into the show, I wanted to share a new service called Getida that Ken and I have been using that has made us over $10,000 in Amazon reimbursements. The service requires no monthly subscription, and Getida collects a small percentage of the money they recover for you. It takes less than 5 minutes to set up and works on all Amazon marketplaces. Go to Getida.com, G-E-T-I-D-A, and enter promo code FTM400. That's FTM for firing the man 400 to get your first $400 in reimbursements commission free. How much money does Amazon owe you?
Welcome everyone to the Firing the Man podcast, a show for anyone who wants to be their own boss. If you sit in a cubicle every day and know you are capable of more, then join us. This show will help you build a business and grow your passive income streams in just a few short hours per day. And now your hosts, serial entrepreneurs, David Schomer and Ken Wilson.
Welcome everyone to the Firing the Man podcast. On today's episode, we have the pleasure of interviewing Joe Rocky, who is a business coach, keynote speaker, and owner of multiple companies. He helps people achieve their version of passionate success. When he was 25, he launched his first business from scratch, and over a decade later, it was strong enough to survive the pandemic. Since 2011, he has launched over 15 different entities in multiple industries, to name a few: podcasting, business consulting, personal growth coaching, keynote speaking, and real estate investment. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Thank you. Well, thank you guys for having me. This is a topic that I'm very passionate about, so I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. So for those of our listeners who are not familiar with you, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself and your path in the business world?
Yeah. So long story short, I've been in sales since I was 18. And when I was coming through college, much like you, I got the accounting and finance double major. But I was coming out at the last recession, where there were people in the first half of the year in the fall taking positions at all of the big accounting houses. And just to find out in May and March, you know, that they were getting pulled away. You know, if you're firing someone with 30 years experience, you're not bringing on someone who's brand new and doesn't know anything. That's pretty basic. So all those accounting jobs that I thought were going to be there and be doing, gone. So I've leaned on my sales ability. As everybody said, every position except for the required internships I took in my college were salesmen. So I ended up being a financial advisor, which in reality ended up being selling life insurance and annuities and taking tests to be credited of that. And I did it very well. First year I was rookie of the year, second year I was underclassman of the year, the third year I left. And I left for a lot of reasons, but one of which was the entire notion of trying to not have any control of my product was not working, because there were people that I met in my first year that I knew I was selling way better product to than in my third year. And I remember distinctly that there was an internal meeting that said the reason we're selling this new product because it's better for the company and it's better for you and your company, your client will deal with it. And that did not sit well with me at all. And that was ultimately the final nail that forced me out the door, along with a lot of other practices that people may understand. But I kind of sum it up to is, if your business says this is the only way we do it and this is how we've always done it, but they can't give you a results reason why, that doesn't sit well with me at all. And, you know, the combination of all that, I started buying my first real estate entities. And from there on, I just started diving into business creation and helping other people make theirs better.
That's awesome. Thanks for sharing, Joe. And so as David mentioned in your bio, you've got a wealth of experience in many different industries and different entities that you've owned and worked with. As entrepreneurs, I think people are always super interested in finding out what are some of your best successes and what are some of the entities that perform poorly. Can you share maybe your top few that went really, really well and it was worth the time and energy you put into it and capital? And then a couple of them the duds that we all learned from.
Yeah, I guess for those out who've been through it, the duds come to your mind quicker about that. One, let's start with them. You know, when I look at kind of the two biggest failures I've had from entities I've created, I look to see what were the trends there, what did I do wrong, and what was the overall situation? It just didn't pan out. Why? And at the end of the day, there were two common threads that not only I saw in my own businesses, but then working with other businesses and gone through the same thing. The first one was the partnership's expectation or owner's expectation, depending on how it's structured, was not in line with what reality ended up being. And that's not necessarily someone's fault. Someone maliciously thought it was going to be this and then sabotage it so it wouldn't be. It's just a reality that we thought it was going to be at this level and it chose a different direction. And I don't want to be a part of that direction. So when you have two partners that are no longer in line, it's destined to implode. So The example, the first one I lived with, this was the second company I created. I wanted to create a rental company because part of the reason that attracted me to selling the annuities and life insurance was I wanted residual income. I wanted to be paid when I was older for work that I did when I was younger. It was very important to me. So at that time, there basically was no subscription-based model unless you were collecting taxes, unless you were collecting mortgage or rent, or you were a utility company. Well, I wasn't going to be able to become a government, and I wasn't going to be able to become a utility company, so it looks like I got to be a landlord. Because in 2011, that was basically the only choice. Knowing that now, I can do different things for residual income. But that was where we started. And the partner that I had that was doing this with didn't have the same long-term goal with my goal, like I said, was I wanted to essentially build a whole network and then be 40, sit on some beach for the next 30 years of my life and never leave. But that was the plan. My partner had, at the time, a first grader, and he just basically wanted to make up the gap that was going to be between his income and what he needed to pay to get her for college. So we were about five houses in or whatever, and he was like, I'm done. I'm going to buy you out now. We're done. And I'm like, this was not the intent. And the way it was structured, he was the capital and I was the one running around doing the effort. So once the capital was gone, that business essentially disappeared. So that was the net result of the first one that fell apart. And that was a direct result of us having different expectations and never really, you know, articulating them as they went downfield. And the second reason that, you know, things have imploded were essentially me being bad at interviews for my partners, them not being able, or maybe it was me. I mean, it's a failure. It falls on everyone equally. Being able to deliver upon what they said they were going to. You know, I'm not going to get into specifics and throw people under the bus, but long story short, he said he was going to bring certain things to the table. I was able to bring certain things to the table, and it looked like it was going to be a perfect zipper and make some good synchronization. And when push came to shove, we were 7 months into it, realized we're just throwing money and energy and time away. It's over. And those are the two things that most of which business failures happen with from a partnership level. And then, like I said, obviously I help people on the sales level, which is the other main elephant in the room. But because my skill set, my companies don't have that problem, which is a great and glorious head start that I love and share.
Got it. I want to talk about the partnerships and maybe some things that you've learned from some of those, what we'll call failed. And I am using air quotes right now because really it's you're taking lessons learned out of that and you're applying them to your next ventures. And so if you're to structure a partnership now, what are some kind of lessons learned or some things you do differently?
So when I build a business now, it's all built around the revenue stream and that's it. And then if I got to do extra for a legal reason, we figure out how to incorporate it. But in my mind, the revenue stream is this straightforward. Say you want a bakery. First step, people need to know your bakery exists and they want to come to it. Second step, when they're at your bakery, they need to feel comfortable enough to give you resources, normally money, in exchange for a promise of an awesome product. And then obviously the bread has to be awesome on the back end. Every company I structure only focuses on those three things. And where I find that the majority of people mess up is that they are really good at being bakers and they want all of their other partners to be also great bakers, but they neglect people finding us and people wanting to be comfortable enough to sell, basically, to exchange back and forth. I have learned, and this is tested true over and over again, is that you have to find someone who wants to do the other departments that you don't, because there is no personality type that will do all of them. It doesn't exist. This is a major problem that I encountered whenever I was in a sales situation required me to do one and two. I don't like doing the whole people find me, come to my bakery. I like doing the once they're at my bake, I'm making some products happen, we're changing contracts, all that fun stuff. I do like doing the processing of making sure I have a good product at the end. That's part of why I created business. But where people get the mistake is they find people that only like doing what they're doing, and because they don't like doing the other side, and then all of a sudden we have greatest spread on the planet, but no one knows about it, and therefore we wonder why we're going out of business because we don't have any sales. At the end of the day, the bakery that lasts the longest and is the most successful is not the one with the most bread, it's the one that does the most sales. And that's a big spot where people fail in partnerships. So that was an example to say what you need to find is people whose strengths mirror your weaknesses and vice versa. What a lot of people fail at is they try to find someone so much like them because they're friends or whatever, which is a good thing. Work with people you trust, but you need to have different skill sets that are complementary and less overlapping.
If you want tips and strategies on how to start, grow, and monetize your business online, check out the Digital Revolution podcast with Eli Adams. We interview digital experts from around the world that share their personal stories. They talk about what they're currently working on and where they see the future going. But most importantly, they share tactics in their specific area of expertise with the hope of helping you improve your digital presence online. You can listen to the Digital Revolution podcast on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, iHeartRadio, or simply click on the link in the show notes below.
Yeah, I like that. Definitely makes sense. So we talked about a couple of the larger businesses that were the most for lessons learned partnerships. Can you speak to a couple of the ones that were super successful and why you think they were?
Yeah. So part of the reason they ended up being successful is they had hiccups in them. I mean, that's a fact of life. Everything you just said about how you already move forward, every one of my entities had this because I'll go to the first one. I don't know if it's necessarily the most successful one, but it's the first one that you always remember the first one. I was doing a flip, and that's basically buying a property that's all messed up, making it better, and then selling the profit that is the equity that I just created. That's what I did. TV calls them flippers on TV, and suitable enough definition right now. The first house I bought, you name it, I did it wrong. I didn't totally understand what the actual layout of the property was in terms of the lot. There was a driveway there that I just assumed was to the house I had, and it wasn't. It was a half driveway. So it had to be split 6 months out of the year. So I got to resell this and, oh, it was a nightmare. The crew I had just took advantage of me to every wit's end. This is incredibly common, by the way. In Pittsburgh, where I'm at, Allegheny County, it's only like 97.8 of the people who do their first flip never do a second one. And I would have been in that boat had I not been arrogant enough to buy the second house I was going to flip before I'd finished the first one, before really even the headache started with the first one. So nightmares left and right all over the place as we're going through the process of the renovation and then the resale. Then it comes around to now I own this house, which literally is a junk. I mean, it's in a neighborhood that will eventually sell for $250,000, but I bought it for $6,000 for a reason. Like, this house is useless. It's basically a husk, a brick husk, and that's it. And going through it, being much more intelligent about the crew that I had, about what we're actually going to do to the house, the whole nine yards. That second one on Franklin took my results of everything I lost in the first house, which was plentiful, especially when it was all of my life savings that I had dealing with that hell company of selling their life insurance. And now, not only made all of that loss back, but it made so much profit that I didn't even think was possible for a single day's transaction. So that house did, by the way, sell for $240,000. So when I knew it was a $250,000 neighborhood, I'm right. So it made me very glad in seeing that, but it was all because there was a problem earlier. And then how do I overcome that? And thankfully, as I've gone further along in life, I'm able to see things deeper in advance. So I don't have a $40,000 loss to teach me something. Now it's like, oh, we can see this is going to be a problem. Let's address it now like adults rather than being scared to talk up. And that's one of the other things is I learned how to become an owner through this process and how to become an effective manager and leader that I never really had an example of in any of my positions before. Every single manager, owner, boss, whatever you would want to call it, for lack of a better word, was horrible. And the fact that I didn't have any of this motive, yet any examples of how to do it correctly, it was a learning on the job process, but I'm definitely glad to say 15 years later, I have fixed that. And now I'm glad that I'm able to teach other people how to become successful managers and not sell like it's the 1960s anymore. I do have a bet, and part of this leads to this is I thoroughly believe in my passion behind why I do my business is I believe salespeople will heal the work. And that's not a joke. So any like macro problem that the politicians say are destroying this country, whether it's true or not, the salespeople are the ones that ultimately will make it go away. So if you believe there's ageism or racism or sexism or any of that, salespeople are the one that will erase it. Because at the end of the day, a successful salesperson is bringing something that will benefit everyone involved because it will help you and it will help us equal. And that's what true sales is an equal exchange and just helping to find the best connections to make that happen, rather than the 1960s route of guilting someone into you, making you feel so bad if you don't buy this, and then you never come back to the used car dealership again. And that's the dichotomy I'm trying to fight here. But the sad truth is the vast majority of the world still sells in the 1960s model, and they just don't realize they're doing, which is why e-commerce is taking off. But that's the opportunity that e-commerce has exploited.
It's a better shopping experience. At least that's our opinion. As we were preparing for the show, I learned that you had an accounting and finance background. And so our next two questions are going to kind of be geared towards that. So from a capital perspective, what are some things business owners should be doing to fund growth in terms of like taking on particular types of debt or equity? Can you talk a little bit about that or bootstrapping? I'll include that one.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're getting into the nuts and bolts of the math behind it. I always try to say you need to recognize that capital is necessary. If you don't have capital, you're going to eventually short. But you also need to recognize that capital is not an excuse not to work. You know, if you want to be truly just on giving someone a bunch of money and they're going to make something happen, that's great. But you're not going to become a truly silent owner and recipient of your income until down the road. You're going to need to be active and involved in what your thing is doing. So I start from those two extremes because people will kind of find the mindset in the middle. The long story short is whatever you think your initial expenses are going to be, I always say double them at least, because that's it if it's a stable market. The less stable, more risky area, you got to make sure you have your capital there, because there's nothing worse than being like three steps away from victory and running out of money and having it. Because you will inevitably put your heart, your soul into this. And it's the equivalent of having a child but not having any food to feed it after he's 9 months old. And you're just going to see it wither and die. You know, people take that very real because it's our lives. It's all our capital involved. It's my life savings. If it doesn't work, we're done. And not to mention all the emotion you put into it, your sleepless nights, your passion, your dreams, you're thinking of what it's going to be, what I could do with this as it grows older. So to answer the initial question about capital is you need to make sure that you have enough. Now in terms of how do we make sure we have more as we're going, you need to also be able to recognize that what is your sales pipeline going to, how long is it going to take from we have this idea until realistically the first revenue comes in? And is that revenue going to come in as a trickle or as a blasting hose? Like, how strong is that revenue going to be? And these are the types of thought processes that there's a mindset of person that just wants to dive into everything that will blow off this conversation. This conversation dictates your longevity, because if you just dive into it expecting a big rush of revenue coming in consistently and quickly, if that doesn't happen, you will die. You know, same as a plant that doesn't get water, it's out. So this is a long way of saying you need to actually think this through and go through it. And this is one of these things where it's a spectrum, right? People who just dive in and people who super plan forever. If you need to be honest with yourself, where do I live on that spectrum? Am I the kind of person who just jumps in and goes for it? Or am I going to sit around and plan forever and have 1,700 spreadsheets on my computer and then figure it out? Because you can go on the internet and see all kinds of different equations about what the capital recommendation is, all that and the other. And I'm not discounting any of it. But at the end of the day, you need the harmony of both sides. You need to be able to say, I want to go and do this. This was realistically thinking of how long it's going to take to get there and make it happen together. Because if you just do one or the other, either A, the company will never get launched, or B, it'll never survive. And that's why you need both together. So hopefully that answered your question. I'm hoping it did. But if it didn't, I will elaborate wherever necessary.
No, that did. That did. Kind of the second part of that question would be, what do you think most business owners get wrong when it comes to running the financial operations of their business?
That's the biggest mistake that I see. Not going a long tangent.
If you're a podcast host or someone wanting to be interviewed on podcasts as a guest, visit podmatch.com. Podmatch automatically connects ideal podcast guests and hosts together for interviews. We always say it works just like a dating app, but instead of connecting you for dates, it connects you for podcast interviews. Podmatch has connected over 85,000 guests and hosts together for interviews that listeners love, all while saving you countless hours of administrative work through built-in automations. If you're ready to level up your podcast interviews on either side of the mic, start today by visiting podmatch.com.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that as entrepreneurs, we're perpetual optimists, and that can come to bite you. I remember Ken and I were having a budgeting conversation the other day, and I was like, all right, it is time. We're mapping out cash flows. Let's put on our pessimist hat for now. We're almost always wearing the optimist hat, but expenses will be greater than we think. Revenues will take longer to come in. And so it's, kind of taking off one hat and putting on the other is sometimes challenging. So
that's true for our personal lives as well. This is just about our business. And since obviously your show is about overcoming the man and getting away from him, this is one thing I tell every person who's doing this. It might be hard and it might take a while. Save up 3 months of your expenses and just have it in a checking account or savings account in a bank, because that's the only true way you can go to a different position without panicking. You know, because if you need a paycheck tomorrow and you're not going to be able to survive and you get fired, what is your next week going to be? What kind of position are you going to accept compared to if I had time to think about it, go through actual logic, have other people bid on me? It's a night and day situation of where you end up at the end of that year, whereas compared to, I better got to take the first thing now or else I'm not going to be able to pay the rent. And that's something I recommend everyone. And businesses need to look the same way. Just as you said, pessimism is going to happen where everything's not costable. It's not really a surprise. And as a result, spending power of our buyers is going to be strained. So it probably will take one. And the way I tell people, this is what I'm writing in my book about mindsets, is that you need to live in a realistic optimism space. You know, realistic, what is the conditions of the world that's going on right now? Well, inflation's going up. Paying people out to work apparently wasn't a good idea. So that's going to be a problem. And as a result, people have less money to buy for our product. How can we position our product as the must-have now that we're prioritizing our money in a way that we haven't done in 5 years, as our average buyer will be doing? How do we position our product as being on that top must-do list right up there with health, water, and shelter? How do we make ourselves right there in that list? And that's the element that people need to figure out. That's the challenge of this new recession we're about to be diving through, whether they call it or not.
Interesting. And I definitely agree with you. That's a whole other show on itself. I think we could probably dive into that. The next question that I have for you, Joe, is it's something that almost probably all business owners face at some point in time. It's overwhelm. You're managing a team. Maybe you have a team. Maybe you have some assistance, and you're doing cash flow, budgeting, inventory. It just piles up emails, and then you're overwhelmed and then you burn out. And so what kind of tips and tricks do you help business owners with from when they hit that brick wall of overwhelm to help them out and get some mind space and clarity and refocus?
Absolutely. So the thing that I say, and this is applicable to every person, regardless of whether you're a business owner or just as a civilian, if you will, the first thing you do or that you need to do is list all the things that go on that are causing this problem. As you said, emails, stuff not getting done, feeling like I have something in the back of my mind, but can't remember what it is, and therefore it's weighing on me. All of this stuff that happens, we need to figure out, is it relevant or not? Very first question. Like, does this need to be in my life? And what we will quickly find out is some of the worst anxiety creators don't. So let's figure out how to get them out of my life. Okay, I'm going to turn off notifications for half of the apps on my phone that are irrelevant that I can't do anything about. Personally, I don't have Amber Alerts turned on my phone. Why? Because I'm never going to find the kid anyway. I know the reason is most of the time it's a divorced dad took his daughter out and the mom's being a bitch. So you might need to edit that out. But that's a fact. So I don't care. But it gives the most anxiety-filled ringtone coming out of an iPhone ever. I'm not having that though. There's nothing I can do about it. I don't want it. I look at my whole list, emails. I click unsubscribe faster than anyone else I know. The first time I get something that this is not going to be actually beneficial, it's either unsubscribe or block, one or the other. And you just go through the list of all. And then you start getting the trickier, like relationships with people that, like, I kind of think I should be dealing with this person, but I'm not really sure. And that's whenever I kind of invite you to say, just distance it. Unless they're within your family or your business, just turn it off for 6 months or start with 6 days and see what happens. And then 6 days become 6 weeks and then 6 months. And you will have the answer during that period of time. If you actually want to have a relationship with that person, you'll find yourself connecting with them. If not, the anxiety will go away as they disappear. And that is really the starting point of what you need to do to declutter your own brain and your own schedule. Now, in terms of specifically in your business, it takes it to a next step. You need to fully know what all of your employees are supporting. supposed to do and what they are doing. And the vast majority of business owners fail here, especially the smaller the business. And I know that's paradoxical. You think that there's only six people in our office, I would know everything they're doing and why. But the reality is, you don't. And most people don't, because they have the wrong compensation packages for their employee. Because it is so much easier to do, as I said before, this is the way we always did it. So here's what we're going to do. You're paid hourly or you're getting a salary. And then we're going to give you a bonus structure maybe elsewhere. I'm going to give an example here of how you can overcome that, because it's very important. And I start with this position because it can be applied to every position. But if I start lower on the ladder, for some reason it clicks better. Imagine that you own a hotel and that the only thing that you care from your housekeeping department is that the rooms are clean and that they are done quickly on time so the new group can come and check in. So you can either do the traditional, we're going to train our staff, pay them hourly, and just keep it moving. It is what it is. If it's not good enough, we'll yell at them type deal. You know, the way that every other housekeeper has ever been basically since the dawn of time. That's option one. Easy, it's safe. You're not going to get yelled at. It's like punting on fourth down. No one's ever going to yell at you because that's what everyone else. We could say, hey, there's two things I care about housekeeping division. I care that it's done clean and I care that it's done fast. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a scale. If it's an A quality done, I'm paying you this much per room, this much for B, C, D. And if you do it F, that's not acceptable. You're not getting paid at all. And I'm going to have you guys work on two of your rooms on the first floor, two of your rooms on the second floor. And each floor is going to have a different manager evaluate. So that way there's no favoritism. It's just, you do this here, you do this there, the judges become boiled out that way. And what you will find from your staff is that you are opening up the door for them to do innovation. You're going to let them figure out what is best for them. Maybe they're better if they do the bathrooms first in all of the room and then circle back and do the rest of them. Maybe they're better if they do one room at a time, but they will figure that out themselves in a way that they are invested in your company and in themselves and giving you a better result without you having to go through it. As long as you are consistent in the way that you are evaluating them, which is very easy to do. You just go through the management level with this exercise. But as long as they are consistently treated the same way, they now care more about your business because you are paying them more based upon their result. And the ones that want to prove good results will become attracted and stay with your company longer. And the ones that don't, which by the way, you don't want as a business owner, will phase themselves out. And at the end of the day, will you be paying more on the hourly rate than you would have? Yes, absolutely. No questions asked. Will you be paying more overall on the gross? Probably not. But your client, your employees are going to have a much better experience working for you because it's going to be, they get paid a lot and I get control my own time. So now I can clean all these rooms between 8 o'clock and 2 o'clock because I'm that fast and good. What used to take me 4, now I can be home in time for my kids coming home from school and I get paid like I was working till I was 6. It's a win-win across the board. Those employees stay with you. And then also when you're hiring people, it is very easy to filter out, I want to be here. Like, I'm actually going to reduce this. They're going to reward me for doing good. And again, I start with the housekeeping example because essentially it's the janitor of every position we're at. And it applies all the way up to the top. So for some reason, we understand this when we're talking about CEO. We give you giant bonuses based upon your stock performance and your sales, but we don't look at it at any other position. And the reality is the more you get your compensation tied to what your employees actually you want them to do, the more accomplished and the more results your company will have. And this was a very long way to get back to, you're going to have less headache because the things that matter to your business will prevail and they themselves will filter out the things that are irrelevant. They're no longer going to be checking Twitter whenever they're in the middle of vacuuming the back bathroom floor because it costs them money. They're now going to be just focused on the work and getting it done. And that's really how you do this. Again, not the normal. It's not the easy way. It's not the hourly rate of the salary thing, but it's successful.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think that aligning interests with business owners and employees makes a ton of sense. And yeah, that's been something that we've been trying to get a little bit more creative on in our business. One thing that we've curious your thoughts on this, as a business owner, I am interested in generating net income. Like that's sure. Basically what I'm after. And there are certain positions that don't necessarily translate. It doesn't translate perfectly, or they could do an excellent job at what they're doing. However, other parts of the company may not function properly and net income either goes up or down. And so like if per hour is a metric, do you have any other suggestions like if per hour is on one end of the spectrum and a discretionary bonus is on the other, like any other compensation systems that have worked well for you?
Well, the commission compensation is what I just outlined. And yeah, that's what I believe to be the best. So if you have a position, these exist that are outside of the revenue stream. They're not getting more people coming through the door, come to our website. They're not actively converting closings, or they're not involved in getting the product to the buyer. If they're not in that stream in the first place, by definition, they're an expense on your business. And this is where things that can really get into the way for major businesses, you know, the Fortune 500 all the time, like legal departments and HR departments. Like at the end of the day, it's an insurance policy, but they're not doing anything to increase your revenue. And actually, and there's when they're involved with the design of your product, they're only costing you revenue because they're holding you back from better innovation. So the answer to that basically is, if this position is not increasing value, why is it? I mean, that's the first fundamental question you ask. This goes back to the thing before outlining the headaches we have. You know, there is value in not getting sued and losing your entire business. Fair. What is the amount and what is the likelihood that even happens? You know, all I'm doing is basically buying shoes from Adidas and then my website's repumping them out to the client. I'm not getting sued if Adidas shoes messed up. I'm not getting sued if FedEx send it to the wrong house. My actual ability of getting sued is pretty negligible because I'm just pushing off to whoever actually did mess up. So therefore, I should have a lien. And then in terms of the HR stuff, do you think that your employees are going to sue you or not? There are obviously the state rules you have to adhere to. I'm not trying to say skip around the law or anything like that. But aside from those legal mandates, there's no real need to dive into that. So what I would say is we got to figure out how do we directly correlate what this person is doing to the revenue. Now, if they're a manager, they're making sure everything is working correctly. It's the same deal. It's just a different percentage based upon what they're overseeing. So you make sure that they're on top of what the employees are doing correct. So my answer is almost always to a direct way of commission. And if there's not a direct way to correlate what they're doing to revenue, something's wrong with that position in the first place. We got to seriously evaluate, should it even exist?
That's interesting. Definitely a good way to look at that. The conversation has been awesome, Joe. Like I always translate it to someone being on the battlefield. Like the conversation with you, we can tell you've been on the battlefield of business for a very long time. And it shows, and I'm really enjoying the conversation. So a couple more questions before we get into the fire round. One is, you help business owners all the time, right? You help them kind of unlock their potential. They're stuck on something, they have problems. So this is what you do, you know, full time. And can you share with the listeners, what are a couple of common problems that you see all the time? And then how do you help business owners solve those?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of them. let's start with the one that I think holds more people back than they realize and probably ever will know. And that is the lack of confidence. And, you know, this starts with people think, especially men, think that they have this mentality that I can compartmentalize my life. And how I am as a father can be different than how I am as a brother, different than how I am as a son, as an owner, as an employee, et cetera. And we think this because we all can remember that time where they woke up and the term paper was due at 4:00 and I haven't started it yet, but goddammit, it'll be done on time. And we've all been there. We've all made it through those situations where we block the rest of life out. And yes, we can do that in the short run. And by short run, I mean 2 days or less. We cannot do that in the long run. And what ends up happening is whatever our highest points are, if there's a point in our life that is direct opposite of this as a low point, it will balance out. And we eventually will go to the low points that we allow in our lives across the board. That's what happened. And most people recognize this and that deteriorates their confidence. So the first thing that I do to try to help people out of this is we need to lean upon what are we actually passionate about and become much more knowledgeable in that arena. And this doesn't matter if it's Harry Potter or Harrier Jets or building a business or whatever. If you have a passion about it and you become deeply knowledgeable about it, you inherently become more confident and talking about it. I know all the spells and all the different stools that they do at Harry Potter. A lot of people won't care. But you'll be able to find your group that does and build it up and be able to teach people. And that's an inherent confidence that comes out. Confidence is also one of the very few attributes that the human species overall universally agrees is attractive. So the more confident that you can be, the more your confidence boils out. And that is the first step of building up a better work. The second step is you need to have the ability to have people when they're feeling something to have an environment where they can get it out. And basically, this is a form of courage where I'm feeling something inside and I need to figure out a way to say it. Even if it comes out weird or stuttery or not grammatically correct or whatever, you need to figure out a way to get it out of it. Allow and buyer where we can receive that information as well without freaking out. You know, we've all had these bosses before that if it wasn't their idea, they were never going to implement it. And they were probably going to shame you for coming up with a better idea. And at the end of the day, that is the worst business culture you could absolutely create. And you need to have the ability to be, say, hey, I recognize that you guys have different thoughts and insights. Help me out with it. It's a very good way to go back to that question before. Why is this job here? Well, let's ask everyone around us and see what they're doing. It's not necessarily that Sally's a bad person. We want to fire Sally. It's we want to make sure she's doing something efficient and productive for the company. So we own that. And that's the kind of workflow courage that needs to be going around. Courage that I can hear something I don't want to hear. I'm not going to explode. And courage, you guys should tell me stuff. And I'm going to tell you stuff. That also goes hand in hand with humility, by the way. Because humility is simultaneously set. It's the balance between saying, I am not the most important person ever. I am the owner, bow down to me or die, nor is it you are the insignificant I don't care about. It's that balance in between and looking at the relationship that we have, this is how we each should act. And then the final note on this is you need to act in the spot where all your decisions are based upon fairness and in a just manner. Like we are choosing to go with this option because we believe it to be the best option. Not because you're the one who said it or you're not the one who said it. You know, I'm hiring, promoting you because I believe you're the best person for this job, not because it'll look good on a PR statement or a magazine, whatever people write this book. And when you combine those four things, knowledge and confidence, courage, humility, and justice, you will fix all of those problems and your company will skyrocket. And that starts with you as an individual owner. And if you can make it the embedding culture of your business, there's nothing that will stop you. It doesn't matter what you're selling, it will work.
Very nice. Very nice. Round things out before we get into the fire round. Can you tell us a little bit more about Elite Business Conversations and how that could potentially be beneficial to our listeners?
Well, Elite Business Conversations is how you hire me to get this knowledge for your business, whether I'd be doing it in an intensive for you directly or whether I'd be presenting it to the entire entity in the form of keynote addresses or training sessions. But you find us at elitebusinessconversations.com. Our first step will be we're going to have a quick little 10-minute chat and see if we're even a good fit for each other. Because that's the first step. We're going to work. Or if not, not, that's okay. And then we just go from that. But it's Elite Business Conversations. It's how you can get access to all this knowledge that I'm sharing and how we can turn your business into the next greatest success story.
That's awesome. Well, cool. So, Joe, for every guest we bring on, we run them through the ringer, and it's called the Fire Round. Are you ready?
All right.
What is your favorite book?
I got three of them. It's Yocko's Extreme Ownership. It's The 10-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss. And it's my own book that will be coming out the second half of the year. So sorry to the shameless plug. But I love what I'm writing.
What's the title of that book?
It's still under the publisher will let me know. But the book is about using your sales skills to overcome a deficit of money. And this specific example I was at Las Vegas when I only had $500 cash in my pocket. And $250 of credit left on my account. It coincidentally was during that period of the $40,000 house loss before the next one took off. So it was how I survived Las Vegas and ended up spending probably close to $5,000 just using sales skills on the casino floor.
Nice. Yeah. When that's out, we'll have you back on the show and we can dive into that one.
I would love to have it. Yeah.
Awesome. Next one. What are your hobbies?
I throw axes. Before I dislocated my shoulder, I was in the top 300 in the world. At Worlds, I finished 192 in Toronto. And I believe that was like 10 minutes before COVID started. So that would have been 19. That was in February. Then we got shut down in March. So yeah.
That's awesome. I literally took my daughter to Kansas City 2 weekends ago and we threw axes. And when I went back to the hotel room, there was the world the axe throwing championships were on TV. I was so impressed. I love that. That's awesome.
Oh, it is so fun. When we started doing that, my brother had a party at it. And then I sat down with my best friend at a bar and we looked at what people's scores were that won everything. And we're like, if we actually practice all the time, we could do that. And now he is in the top 10 of the world and he won their US Open last year. He didn't dislocate his shoulder, but that's not how it goes. It's something that anyone get into. It's not a strength game. It's a skill and fundamental repeating game. It's a great drinking game as well.
That's awesome. All right. Next question. What is the one thing that you do not miss about working for the man?
This is the way we always did it, so you're going to be forced to do it.
Yeah. Last one. What do you think sets apart successful entrepreneurs from those who give up, fail, or never get started?
Being able to live the commission lifestyle. It's incredibly stressful, but when it works, oh, is it great.
Very cool. David, you want to close out the show?
Absolutely. Joe, if people are interested in getting in touch with you, what would be the best way?
Reach out to us through elitebusinessconversations.com. Like I said, we'll set up a little 10-minute chat.
Awesome. And we'll post links to that in the show notes. Joe, want to thank you for being a guest on the podcast. And when that book comes out, let's get in touch and have you back on.
I would love to be back. Yeah, it'll be the second half of the year, guys.
Awesome. Sounds great. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you.
Before you go, we wanted to share a new service that Ken and I have been using called Getida that has made us over $10,000 in Amazon reimbursements. The service requires no monthly subscription, and Getida collects a small percentage of the money they recover for you. It takes less than 5 minutes to set up and works on all Amazon marketplaces. Go to Getida.com, G-E-T-I-D-A.com, and enter promo code FTM400. That's FTM for Firing the Man 400 to get your first $400 in reimbursements commission free. How much money does Amazon owe you?